Right in Parshas Ba'era, the mission to Paro has gotten off to a rocky start, but nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends a message through Moshe to Bnei Yisrael. It will end well, and we have in the beginning of the Parsha the famous Arba Geulos. So Tzeisi, Vitzalti, Vigaalti, Velokachti, and Vehevesi. And this is the message of encouragement that Moshe is sent with to Bnei Yisrael. And sadly, as the Pasuk tells us, the Jewish people weren't so receptive to the message. The Pasuk tests of Perek Vav, Vayidaber Moshe Kena Bnei Yisrael. V'lo shomu Moshe. They didn't listen. Mikotz ruach u'miavodah kasha. Through kotz ruach, through hard work, they just couldn't find it within themselves to be receptive to the message. And on a simple parshanut level, we need to ask, what are these two conditions? What are these two symptoms? Kotz ruach and avodah kasha. Avodah kasha is easier to understand. It's hard work. Kotz ruach is somewhat more elusive. What is the meaning of kotz ruach? And what is there a relationship between these two things? Are they two separate things, or do they work together? The Vilna Gaon gives a very straightforward Heirush. This comes from his Biur on Shir HaShirim. And he explains that there are two types of difficulty, two types of persecution that one could envisage. The first, of course, is the classic Avodah Kasha, hard work, that's Inui. But there's another type where the work is not necessarily hard per se, but it's without respite. There's no let up. There's no break. There's no time to catch your breath. It's unremitting and seemingly unended. Initially, as we know, the Jewish people, they had to work building, but as we can see, the bricks were given to them. Now, what that means is that as hard as the work was, but they did have time to themselves. It means when they finished working, so then they had a bit of a break. During those times, as much as they're recovering from the hard work, but it's possible to speak to them, and to speak to them about good things. However, as we know, Paro's instruction as a result of the first meeting with Moshe is Tevin lo yinotin lahem, that they're not going to get any straw to make the bricks. They've got to go and get it themselves. What does that mean? It's not merely, quote unquote, making things harder for them. And there isn't actually anything particularly arduous about gathering straw. It's not that hard. What it does do is it consumes all of the time that they otherwise would have had to get back to themselves. There is no break anymore when they're not doing the Avodah Kasha, be scouring the land for straw. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, on the simplest of levels, Moshe comes with a message, and from a certain point of view, part of the question is, Mikotz ruach and Avodah Kasha. It sounds like these are conditions that only exist now. But remember, originally, when Moshe came and spoke to the Jewish people, Bayamein Ha'am, they did listen. They were not suffering from Avodah Kasha at the time. So it sounds like this is a new thing, but they've had Avodah Kasha the whole time. Quite so. But initially, Moshe was able to speak to them when they weren't doing Avodah Kasha. They were resting, they were in one place, and he could talk to them, and they listened. But now, Lo shamu el Moshe, says the Gaon, doesn't even so much mean that they weren't receptive. They couldn't hear him. There wasn't an opportunity or a forum to get them together. When will you find them all in one place? Never. Because when they're working, you can't talk to them. And when they're not working, they're all over the place. And therefore, the chiddush of kotzer ruach. Kotzer ruach, says the Gaon, means there isn't really any spaces in between. There's no ruach. There's no time where they can take a breather. There's no gap time. The combination of kotzer ruach and avoda kasha ensured that you could never really get them together to speak to them. And therefore, lo shamu el Moshe, no one could hear him. They couldn't meet. That's how the Gaon explains. And therefore, kotzer ruach for the Gaon means as a result of this new edict that they have to collect the straw themselves, there's no ruach anymore. There's no spare time. Others understand that everything that they're required to do, whether it's the building or whether it's the gathering of the straw, that's all called under the rubric of avodah kasha. But then, what would be kotzer ruach? If now, whatever they have to do is called avodah kasha, so what is the connotation of kotzer ruach? The Rachaim HaKodesh says, the idea of kotzer ruach means ruach in the sense of spirit, or ruach in the sense of a ruchaniut, of spirituality. That somehow has been curtailed, or brought to a halt for them. And the question is, how? We understand that the work has gotten harder, that in terms of Gashmias, life is more difficult now. But somehow that also brought with it what's called kotzer ruach, their ruchnius has taken a dip. How does one thing lead to the other? So the Sefer Shiras David explains that there's a very interesting medrash in the end of Parshas Shemos, and it relates to Paro's words there. For in Perek Hei, Pasuk Tes, his reaction to Moshe's demand that they let the Bnei Yisrael go is to say, and Pasuk Tes reads, Tichbad ha'avoda al ha'anoshim. Make things more difficult for them. Make the workload heavier for them. V'yasuba, and they should be active in it. V'al yish'u b'divrei shaker. Va'al yish'u b'divrei shaker. And let them not... Well, what is the word yish'u? Yish'u could mean to speak. Yish'u could mean to turn. The word sho'er means to turn. We find in Parshas Bereishis, when Hevel brings his korban and Cain brings his korban, it says, Vayisha Hashem el Hevel. Hashem turned, that is to say, he accepted it. Ve'el Cain ve'el minchaso lo sho'o. The word sho'er can mean to turn, to direct one's attention to something. There's an interesting comment that we find in a couple of places in the Talmud. It's a well-known statement. Yesh kona olamo b'shah achas. It's possible for a person to receive his entire world in 1 hour. And on a simple level, that means that even within a relatively short amount of time, everything can change. A person can undergo a complete transformation. Shah achas means 1 hour. My uncle Rav Cooperman likes to mention the explanation that Yeshkona Olama B'Shah Achas means sometimes a person's entire destiny is determined by one turn, by one change of direction. Very often a decision early on to go one way or the other, it's just that one moment. But the way that a person turns, it either puts them on an upward trajectory or perhaps on a plateau, if not a downward trajectory. It's that one turn that then leads one thing to the other, and it all began with that one change of direction, that sha'a achas. And therefore the pashtus of al yishu b'divrei shaker, let them not talk of matters of falsehood. Where's the falsehood? Anything that Paro doesn't like is falsehood. Any talk of redemption or freedom, that's false, because it's not on Paro's agenda. Or let them not turn their attention to such things. But the Medrash Mos Rabbah explains that the word, again, al yish'u, yud shin ayin vav, is from the word sha'ashua. And sha'ashua, as we know, is a delight, Haben Yakuli Ephraim, Im Yeled Shashuim, Lishta Sheya. What's the background to this? What are they delighting? And what? Why is their delight called falsehood for Paro? And the Medrash explains that Moshe, early on, it's very interesting, we don't have much of a Masorah about Moshe's interactions with Paro before he left. But the Medrash says that when he was yet younger, before he ran away, he arbitrated on the part of the Jewish people that they shouldn't have to work every single day. 7 days a week, they'll just wear themselves out. And therefore he put the suggestion to Paro, kiviyachol, in the interests of better production for Paro, that they should have 1 day a week where they can just recharge and the other 6 days will look completely better. Otherwise, they'll just run themselves into the ground. And the day that he chose was Shabbos. Moshe intuited that Shabbos should be the day of rest. This is before Matan Torah. And that's why they say, on Shabbos morning, we say, Yismach Moshe b'matnas chelka. Moshe was delighted to receive his chelek. That means that when he actually heard that Shabbos is the day, that was a great simcha for him, because he had intuited that Shabbos should be the day that they rest. The question is, what will they do? How does one rest? Well, the Balabatisha answer is simply by doing nothing. That Moshe had a program for them. And the Medrash says that he wrote Megillos for them. In other words, he wrote things for them to be mechazik them, and to encourage them, and to uplift them. He wrote Megillos for them. Interestingly, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests, for there is an opinion in Maseches Bava Basra, in the end of the first perek, that Eov, who's somewhat elusive in terms of pinning him down, where did he live, who was he, and in whose time did he live? There's a number of possibilities. And some, but the Sefer Eov, says the Gemara, was written by Moshe Rabbeinu. For those that understand that he lived before Moshe's time, it was put into a Sefer for Moshe. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests that that at least some form of Sefer Eov was part of these Megillos that Moshe was talking. Because Eov's life is a catastrophe. And he's looking to find meaning in it and explain it, and it all works out in the end. And Moshe would tell them the story of Eov to encourage them. Eov had a difficult time. It ended out okay. You have a difficult time. We'll also be okay. And there were other things that he spoke to them about. And these were the Megillos Shehayu Mishtash Im Bahem. They were their delight. They kept them going. They kept their spirits alive. And at the time, Paro didn't mind, because on the contrary, they returned. As far as he's concerned, they're not going anywhere. If they have these delusions of some time coming free, if it makes them better workers, he didn't mind. So it's what they call in the vernacular, win-win. Jewish people are, relatively speaking, happy with their Shabbos. Paro's happy because from Sunday to Friday, they're working very well. Tichvat Ha'avoda, one of the chidushim of Paro after this first meeting, is to cancel Shabbos. Tichvat Ha'avoda means there should be no day of rest. That's finished. Va'al yish'u b'divrei shakar. He cancelled that opportunity that they had to get together and to learn these Megillos and to uplift their spirits. There's none of that anymore. Al yishtash'u b'divrei shakar. And what that means is the Jewish people, says the Shiras David, no longer have a base, a regular input of this type of idea that they can resonate. When Moshe comes to talk about the Geula, that's been deleted from their lexicon now. I mean, they don't have time to talk about these things or to think about these things. And that is why Tichvat Ha'avoda, the increase in the workload, which deleted now and sidelined Shabbos as a day, A, of rest, and B, where they could revive their ruchnias. So they're now in a state of kotzer ruach. They're very short on ruach now. They don't talk about these things anymore. That's in the past. And mi'avoda kosha, the hard work, only made things more difficult. So this is the explanation of the Shiras David, using the understanding of the Orach Haim HaKadosh that kotzer ruach represents a drop in ruchnias, and attaching it to the, and combining it with the Medrash Rabbah to understand that that was the day that they had. They had a day of ruchnias, which has since been taken from them as a result of the first meeting. And now kotzer ruach and avodah kasha are a deadly combination to quash any type of receptiveness that they may have to Moshe's words. But the Geula is nigh, and as a prelude to the Makos and everything that follows, we have in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yudalet, the lineage of Moshe. And it begins, actually, what looks like the lineage of the whole Jewish people, because it's Sheni. Pasuk Yudalet begins Eile Roshei Beisavosam and begins with Bnei Reuven. So we have Reuven's sons, who are they? Chanoch and Falu, Chetzron and Carmi. And then we have Shimon and Pasuk Tesvav and his sons. And then in Pasuk Tetzayin we have Levi. And it seems as if everything is really leading up to Levi, because once we get to Levi, we don't go further. We get to Levi, and then we drill downwards to his sons, and then his grandsons, and then his Moshe and Aaron, and then so Reuven and Shimon. We're not really going to present everyone. It's clearly directed towards Levi, but we don't start with Levi. We start with Reuven and Shimon. When we get to Levi, then we stop, because that's where the two redeemers are, Moshe and Aaron. But then why do we mention Reuven and Shimon? If at the end of the day, I mean, Moshe and Aaron are not from Reuven and Shimon, they're from Levi, and you're not going to mention everyone, so why do we start in that way? The Ma'asei Hashem has a very interesting question, that observation with regards to these psukim. We have, essentially, successive psukim. The sons of Reuven, the sons of Shimon, the sons of Levi. How are they introduced? Let's see. Pasuk Yudalet. Eile Roshei Beisavosam. Who's first? Bnei Reuven. And who are Bnei Reuven? They are Chanoch, Ufalu, etc. Next. Pasuk Tesvav. Bnei Shimon. And they are Yumuel, V'yamin, V'ohad, etc. And then Pasuk Tetzayin. Ve'eile Shemos Bnei Levi L'toldosam. Gershon, Ukahos, Umurari. It's interesting that when it comes to introducing the sons of Reuben and Shimon, they're called the sons of Reuben and Shimon. That's who they are. But we're introduced, of course, to how does the Pasuk refer to them? By their names. What else will we say? Which means that when you introduce them, you mean these are their names. I mean, these are them. These are the names. Bnei Reuven, Bnei Shimon. But the third Pasuk does not say Ve'ele Bnei Levi. It says, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Levi. But what do you mean by saying the names of B'nei Levi? I mean, and what did you tell me? You told me exactly what you told me for Reuven and Shimon. So, whether you introduce them as the sons of, or the names of the sons of, they're all heading to the same place. Why then does the Pasuk shift? And whereas for the first two it spoke about the sons themselves, ultimately, or in the third case, it introduces them as Shemos B'nei Levi. That's an interesting shaila. The person is his name, certainly, is in terms of a presentation like this. And the Ma'asei Hashem explains. As we know, the two redeeming personalities, they are Moshe and Aaron, and they're from Levi, and of course, that's a fact, and we take it as a given. But nonetheless, remember, Levi is not the firstborn. He's not the secondborn. Is there any notion that perhaps intuition would say, Reuben is the Bechor, should the Goel come from him? And if not, why not? Did Levi do anything to merit being the one from whom the Redeemers would come from him? It says, the Ma'asei Hashem, he did. You see, we have a principle, and it can have many variations and emanations. Kol Misabel, we say if a person is Misabel on the Churban, if a person has a sense of loss during Golus, that itself is a schus to see the Geula. And the Ma'asei Hashem says, not only does that mean that he has a schus to be witness to the Geula, if someone has a keen sense of being in Golus, that can be a merit to be instrumental in bringing the Geula. What is possible to say about Levi is that Levi preserved a sense of being in Golos. And that was the equivalent of Misabel on the Churban. And this is a distinctive feature of Levi. He was keenly aware that he was in Golos, and it became a schus for his children. How can we see it? Says the Ma'aseh Hashem, you can see it in the names of his children. Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kehos, Umarori. What do they have in common with each other? Says Ma'aseh Hashem, they're all representations and expressions of Golos. The first one, Gershon, which is either derived from the word Ger, or Gerush, which is, represents the fact that we're strangers here, or we've been thrown out of our actual land. That's number one. He's the first. Who's next? Kehos. What is the connotation of the word Kehos? Kehos means something that's blunt or frustrated. We have the famous Hakeyes Shinov for the Ben Russia. Shine Bonim Tikheno. It represents something that's frustrated. That's what it means for the Jew to be in Golos. He's in a frustrated experience. His teeth are blunted. He's not in full capacity and he's not in full splendor. Who's third? Merari. Merari comes from the word mar, and that's bitter. So it's very interesting, because if we take note of the names of Kehos's children, essentially they carry with them, by their very name, an ongoing awareness that we are not in the state that we should be in. We're Gerim. It's Kehos. It's bitter for us. And preserving an awareness like that, Levi was Zocha, that it would be his descendants who would actually be instrumental in getting the Jewish people out of them. And this, says the Ma'aseh Hashem, is what the Pasuk is highlighting. As it goes through Reuven and Shimon, there, Reuven is first, Shimon is second, but it's not Reuven, it's not from Shimon. Why? Because these are B'nai Reuven, these are B'nai Shimon, but when it comes to Levi, it doesn't say these are B'nai Levi, because it wants to tell you what's unique what's unique about Levi. If we may pre-borrowed expression, Ma nishtana ha-shevet hazeh mikol ha-shvatim, the answer is, Eile Shemos B'nai Levi. Look at his son's names, and you'll see everything you need to know. Gershon, Kehos, and Merari, those are people that are worthy to beget the Goalim. And moreover, Mefarshim extend this idea, not only the awareness of being in Golos stands Levi in good stead, that his from him will come Moshe and Aaron, but the whole of Shevet Levi, we know, we have a Mesorah, they were exempt largely from the Avodah Kosher. Why? What did they do? We know that Levi was involved in Torah. When everybody turned up, Levi didn't turn up. In fact, there's a very interesting biur of the Chidah in his Peirush Simchas HaRegel to Haggadah Shel Pesach, where we say Avodim Hayinu and Afilu Kulanu Chachamim, Kulanu Nevodim, Kulanu Yodim Satorah. Even if we're all wise, we know the whole Torah. And most of us, we don't know the whole Torah, but we know the whole Haggadah, presumably at a certain stage. But still, Mitzvah Aleinu Lesaper. And the question is, well, why would one think that if he's a Chacham, then he doesn't have to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? So of course, on a simple level, because he knows the story already. And then the point is that it's not about knowing the story, it's about experiencing the story. Even wise people need to experience things. They're not exempt from experiences. Otherwise, all the wise people would have been left behind in Egypt when everyone else went out, because they knew what would happen. Everyone has to leave. But the Chidah says there may be another reason why a person would think a Chacham doesn't have to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because what's Yetzias Mitzrayim all about? Avodim Hayinu, it was so difficult, and then Hashem saved us, we were slaves, and then we weren't slaves anymore. But there was one group of people that were never slaves in that way, and that's Shevet Levi. What was their distinction? They were Chachamim, they were Navonim, they were Yodim Es HaTorah, and therefore enter the Chacham to Seir tonight and says, well, you know, maybe I don't really need to tell the story the way everybody else does, because all the others, presumably, they would have been in the hard work and they've got to tell the story of how they were set free. But someone like me, of course, it's something of a liberty to take, a presumption, but nonetheless, I would have been like Levi. So maybe I don't really share that story. Says the Haggadah, nonetheless, mitzvah aleinu lesaper. And the reason why is because the benefit of Yetzias Mitzrayim is not only about me'avdus lecheiros and me'shibud legeula, it's about leaving Mitzrayim to receive the Torah. Everyone benefits from that. And therefore, the more you understand what the ultimate purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim is, the more you'll see that even someone who feels that he would have been in that group that weren't subject to hard labor, that doesn't mean Pesach didn't happen for him. He is as much a beneficiary of Pesach as everyone else is. And what's fascinating is, says the Chidah, that explains to us what comes next in the Haggadah. After Kalamar B'Lestapu Yitzias Mitzrayim Reis and Meshubach, we have a story. Maaseh. Who's in the story? Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Shua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Lozab and Azariah, Rabbi Kiva, they're all there. What's interesting about these five individuals, says the Chidah? None of them would have been in the hard labor of Mitzrayim. Because Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanes and Rabbi Shua ben Chananya are Leviim. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah were Kohanim. And who's fifth? Rabbi Kiva, who's descended from Gerim. So none of them are actually descended from people that were involved in the hard labor. And look what their Seder was like. There was no stopping them until they were stopped. And that demonstrates the point. Everyone, mitzvah aleinu lesaper, because everyone's a beneficiary of Matan Torah, also the Leviim, and also B'nai HaGerim. And therefore, Levi was exempt from the Avodah Kosha. But there's another aspect of Levi being exempt, and it will bring us back to our discussion. As we've seen, Levi preserves an awareness of being in Golos. There is a tzad to say that as there were different levels predicted for the Egypt experience, Geri Yazara Chaber Eslalahem, they'll be strangers. Vavodim V'inu Osam. Now we know that there was not hard work for the whole duration. So apparently some of it just Gerim, and then it graduates or deteriorates into the other stages of Avodim V'inu Osam. But the question is, what marks the transition? Or what brings about the transition? How can we know how long, or what would determine how long we can just be Gerim and just, quote-unquote, Gerim, or moving into the other areas of Avodim V'inu Osam? So the Mefarshim say, it really depends. It depends on the Jewish people. It's important that the Jewish people, they need, in order to forge their identity, they've got to be Gerim Be'eretz Lolahem. They have to be distinct and not really part of what's going on in order that they can get themselves together and disavow themselves of the host culture. But that is up to them. If they see themselves as Gerim, it's possible that the other, the more difficult levels of hard work and all of that, which further, in a sense, disavow them of an affinity with their surrounding culture, it could be that those could be delayed and perhaps even avoided. The pasuk says, Va'avodum, Geri Yazara, Va'avodum, V'inu Osam. The letter Vav is a very interesting letter. It can mean a number of things. It can mean and it can mean or. Kabeid es avicha v'esimecha means honor your father and your mother, not or your mother, and both. But the pasuk says, "Make aviv v'imo mosyumas." If a person strikes his father or his mother, not and. The vav, depending on context, can mean and a and b. It can mean a or b. And now we see the language which is predicted, and it's so, of course, so volatile to predict such a national experience so far in advance. It's left open. Here are the possibilities. Geri Yazarecha, that will definitely be true. Will anything else happen? Perhaps. It depends. It's subject to the behavior of the Jewish people. It could be just Ger. It could also be Va'avodum. Could also be Va'avodum. It could also be V'inu Osam. It depends on the Jewish people. And we find, as we mentioned from the Chasam Sofer, that the what ushers in the oppression on the part of the Egyptians, as we see in the beginning of Parsha Shemos, it says, Vayomos Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hador ahu. Yosef, his brothers, that whole generation died out, and then the Jewish people, they begin to multiply. Vatimalei ha'aretz osam. Says Chasam Sofer, this is not a good pasuk. when the pasuk says that Yosef and the brothers and the whole generation died, it means that Yosef and the brothers, they came in with an awareness of as Gerim. They had no notion of becoming part of indigenous society. But there came a time when that generation died out, and with it died that awareness, died that consciousness. And there was a new move. And that is, as the Jewish people increased, Vatimalei Ha'aretzosem, they're looking to spread out. They're looking to move to the west side, not just to stay on the east side. And Vatimalei Ha'aretzosem, as if to say, we can be there together and to be with the best of them. Maybe we're not so different. They're losing a sense of Ger Yezarecha. The very next pasuk says, "Vayakom Melech Chadash Mitzrayim." He doesn't know Yosef. It's trouble for the Jewish people. It's a very, very difficult message to swallow, because there's a part of the Jew that doesn't want to feel uncomfortable in Golus. He wants to feel yet comfortable, but he may force destiny to bring upon him a way of maintaining his sense of distinctness that otherwise he wouldn't have wanted to happen. And as the Jewish people forget the ways of Yaakov and Yosef and his brothers, so then Paro needs to remind them, and that reminder takes the form of Va'avod and Vi'inu Osam. Harder to feel part of indigenous society when they're enslaving you. It's a terrible thing to happen. And this is it's true of Golus Mitzrayim, and in a broad sense, it remains true. Unfortunately, it remains true for subsequent Golios, and it's a lesson we hope that we don't need to, you know, to have to relearn. And therefore, what we can perceive within Levi, having I'll pee the words of the Ma'aseh Hashem, Levi embodies this awareness. Levi embodies Ger Yezarecha. We're Gerim, Gershon, Kehos, Umarari. That awareness themselves allowed them to remain as Gerim alone, even as the others were losing that awareness and had to undergo those harsher climates. And that perhaps is another reason why Levi was spared that difficulty. So, from general discussions, we move to the Makos, and of course the first of the Makos is Dam. And I'd like to refer to a Rashi in Perek Zayin. Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yutes. And this is how the Makkah begins. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe emor el Aaron. So Hashem tells Moshe to tell Aaron. He's got to bring about Makkas Dam. Okay. Why? Rashi explains. Lefi shehegin hayor al Moshe. Because the Nile protected Moshe, kishenishlach l'toko, when he was put into it, lefichach lo loka al yodo, and therefore the Nile would not be hit by Moshe. Lo bedam, velo betzvardim, not the first two plagues, because both of them involved hitting the Nile, veloka al yedei Aaron. Rather, Aaron did it. So clearly, although Moshe, he is the natural choice for the one to bring about the Makkos, and he will. But amazingly, for the first two, bad midos. It's not right. The Nile protected him, he can't hit the Nile. And therefore, Aaron, the first 2 months, Moshe doesn't do anything. He just tells Aaron to do things. Now, many Mefarshim are perturbed by this notion. I mean, it's such a well-known Rashi. All children know it, and children understand it, which is good. But when children understand it and grown-ups don't, then it's not so good. So the Nile helped Moshe, so you can't hit the Nile. We're dealing here with a concept called Hakara Sato, gratitude. But one needs to ponder the notion of what it means to be grateful to the Nile. We almost seem to be ascribing to the Nile some type of a consciousness. Number one, to appreciate Moshe's gratitude. Or number two, to be deserving of Moshe's gratitude. But to be deserving of it, the Nile has to have done something for Moshe. But the Nile didn't really do anything for Moshe. The Nile flowed, because it's a river, and that's what rivers do. It's true that Moshe benefited from it, but the notion of having some type of a grateful relationship with the Nile, it seems to be missing attraction. Hard to say that the Nile put itself out for Moshe. Moreover, and there's a very interesting follow-up question, because let's take the concept of Hakaras HaTov and move with it. For what are we saying? Moshe owes the Nile a debt of gratitude. He should really do the Nile a good turn. So Mefarshim ask a very interesting follow-up question. Is there anything that Moshe can do that would express his gratitude? What can he do a favor for the Nile? The answer, astonishingly, is yes. He should hit it. Because when he hits the Nile, it will turn to blood. And when it turns into blood, the Nile, for once, will stop being what it normally is, namely the object of Avodah Zarah for the Egyptians, and for 1 week in its idolatrous existence, be the subject of an object of Kiddush Hashem. That's if you're asking, is there any favor you could do for the Nile? What would be best in the Nile's interest? Finally, give it a week's break. Make it a chepz of Kiddush Hashem. Unless you say that, well, maybe the Nile doesn't really think that far ahead. It's difficult to know once you've started. I mean, where do you stop? Adarabba, it will be its finest hour. The best thing you could ever do for the Nile is to hit it. It will never stop thanking you. Things only get worse, by the way, because they can. And when we get to the third plague, which is Makas Kinim, and there again, what form does it take? Moshe hits the dust. But of course, it's not Moshe that hits the dust. Once again, it's Aaron that hits the dust. Because Moshe can't hit the dust. Why can't Moshe hit the dust? Rashi says, because he also has a debt of gratitude to the dust. Because Emor al Aaron, Pasuk Yud Beis of Perek Ches, Lo Haya Ofer Kedai Lo Kosai De Moshe. Moshe can't hit the dust. That's pasnished. Because Lefisha Hegenoel, the dust also helped Moshe. Kishahoreges Hamitzri Veit Beneu Bechol. He killed the Egyptian. He buried him in the sand. So Beloka Aide Aaron. Now, in addition to the issues that we've raised above, here one could perhaps question further. Because the Nile did help Moshe. I mean, it took him out of circulation and led him to Batya, and then he was saved. The dust didn't actually help Moshe, because he buried the body in the sand as if to hide things and then be okay. 24 hours later, he's running for his life, because Dasan and Avirim are there. So, in terms of favors, the dust didn't really do him a favor. So why does he owe a debt of gratitude? Unless we say, which is a somewhat uncomfortable thing to say, that as much as the dust didn't actually help him, but it tried. It did its best. But it doesn't have a best, because it's just dust. So all you have is a result, and there's no results. So these are major questions. Rashi brings these comments, and it's from Chazal. So what does it mean? Rav Dessler, in the Mikra of Milyo, has a most profound insight into these two Rashis. It's a lesson for life. He begins by laying out for us what he terms two types of truth. There is intellectual truth, and there is emotional truth. Now, what does that mean? Intellectual truth is what we would call the truth. That is to say, it's correct, as opposed to being incorrect. It's demonstrably correct. Emotional truth is something that it can happen sometimes. It's something feels wrong, even though it isn't. And really, the best way to classify these two situations that Rashi is talking about is exactly like that. They are intellectually, there doesn't seem to be much truth here. You don't owe the Nile a debt of gratitude or the dust. But emotionally, nonetheless, I mean, these are entities that saved Moshe, and therefore for Moshe to hit them would feel wrong, even if it's not wrong. The question is, well, if it's not wrong, what difference does it make if it feels wrong? The answer, says Rav Dessler, is midos and values, they are a product of a person's emotional sensitivities. The values that a person acts upon, the values that a person lives by, are not the values of which he is intellectually aware. They are values of which he is emotionally conscious. As we know, we're all aware of the whole spectrum of values, but the ones that we live by are the ones we take to heart. Which means that midos rely on emotional sensitivity. If a person becomes emotionally insensitive to something, he ceases to act on that value. And therefore, says Rav Dessler, an amazing thing. Given the fact that in some of these situations, although intellectually, that is to say, really, there is no debt of gratitude, but because the person feels like they're being ungrateful, the Nile Satan, and he strikes the Nile, part of him feels that that's not right. A person's emotions are desensitized by violating their values. And even if it's not a real violation, but it feels like a violation, the emotions are still desensitized because we're in the realms of the emotion. And therefore they can become dulled by going through enough times where he does something that feels ungrateful, that dulls his sense of gratitude. And when he really needs it, for example, if someone does him a favor, he'll find himself less forthcoming in terms of being grateful. Why? This is a real case. But the value has been dimmed for him. It's been jaded for him by all those times that he it was enough for him to feel emotionally that he's being ungrateful to be desensitized to it. It's almost as if a person's emotions need to be protected for when he really needs Hakaras HaTov, and therefore they need to be distanced even from things that only emotionally feel like a violation of Hakaras HaTov. That's a very interesting perspective. And moreover, says Rav Dessler, when we talk about these two types of truths, intellectual versus emotional, we need to be aware further that they have different clocks. They have different senses of time. That is to say, the intellect embraces the all tenses. It's aware of the past, aware of the present, aware of the future. That's an intellectual sweep. An emotional state only recognizes the present. You find that when someone is very emotionally either overwrought or invested or somehow connected to something, they're only aware of the present. If a person, let's say, is emotionally run down, they lose sight of, they can't remember when they felt better, and they can't think about when they will feel better. All there is now. Very often, and unhelpfully, there's a helpful person standing next to them, telling them all about these very distant and concepts called the future or the past. And this person is a bastion of time sweep, because they're not emotionally impacted by the situation, so their intellect is free to talk about it. You're being unreasonable, it's only for now, it will pass. There is no it will pass. Someone who is predominantly emotional, there's no future to speak of. There's only now, and now he's miserable. Children, for example, who are much more emotionally alert than intellectually, there is only the present for them. However it is now, it will always be. When they have a feud with one of their friends, they'll never speak to each other ever again. And then 3 minutes later, when they're friends again, they will always be friends. There's an eternal present. That's how the emotions work. And therefore, says Rav Dessler, not only do we understand why it's wrong for Moshe to hit the Nile, but moreover, you can't ask a question. This is a very beautiful follow-up here. You can't ask the question that, well, if you follow through on the logic, and you wish to express your gratitude to the Nile, so hit it, and you will then turn it into an object of Kiddush Hashem, because that's in the future. But the damage is done in the present. But you hit the Nile, that's now, and it feels wrong. And the emotion won't be healed by what will come of it, because the emotion only recognizes the present. And because the present is hitting the Nile, that's an act of, feels like an act of ingratitude. And therefore, Moshe has to step to the side, and Aaron comes in. And it's really, more than anything else, a tribute to the central importance of preserving a sense of Hakaras HaTov, because it's not with every midah that we protect the emotional truths that surround the actual truths, but we do here, because the person can't afford to be without Hakaras HaTov. If he doesn't recognize good, so then he's completely paralyzed. In every sense, what's his whole life working towards? He wants to get his sakhar, and when he gets his sakhar, it's up to him as to whether he recognizes that something good is happening to him. And therefore it has to be protected at all costs. And so, the Torah, as we engage in the Makkah itself, and that's in Perek Zion, the Torah tells us, as a good few psukim, we know that it's not only the Nile that's turned into blood, but it's also all the waters of Mitzrayim. As the pasuk says in the pasuk Yud Tes, Vayadam b'chol eretz Mitzrayim uva etzim uva avonim. Right, even as Unkler says, in vessels of wood, in vessels of stone, there's a mug of water, will also turn into blood. But everything, not just the Nile. It is interesting to note, however, that as much as the water of the Nile is turned into blood, and all the water in Egypt is turned into blood, the pasuk refers to both of them, but it doesn't refer to them in the same way. For if we take a look, for example, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, which talks about the Nile, it says, "Kamar Hashem, Bezos Teda, Kien Hashem, Hine Anuchim Makeh B'Makeh Hashem Yadi, Al Hamayim Hashem Bayor, V'Nehefchu Ledam," and they will turn into blood. Okay. So the verb that's used for the water of the Nile turning into blood is V'Nehefchu, and further, as in the end of Pasuk Kaf, says Vayachas Hamayim Asher Bayor Le'enei Paro Ule'enei Avodim Vayehafchu Kol Hamayim Asher Bayor Ladam. All the water in the Nile turned into blood. Vayehafchu. Contrast that with Pasuk Yotes, which talks about all the other water, where it says Al Meim Mitzrayim Naharosam Ye'orehem Agmehem etc. Vayehiyudam, and they will be blood. V'hayadam b'chol eretz Mitzrayim v'veitzim v'avonim. So we have the same thing, the same phenomenon, and yet when it comes to the Nile, the verb used is v'yafchu. When it comes to the other water, the verb is v'yihyu. But what's the difference between them? They'll only be blood because they turned into blood from water. It's the same thing, but the Torah doesn't use the same word. That's interesting. What's of further interest is, what was it that brought about this change? Once again, we will see that there was a different act or action that brought about the change in the Nile as opposed to the other water. For in the Nile, it says in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Hine Anochi Makeh B'Matei Asher Yodi, as we've been saying. It's about hitting the Nile. Alamayim Asher Bayor. And similarly in Pasuk Kaf, Vayorim B'Mateh Vayachas Amayim Asher Bayor. So how was the water in the Nile turned into blood? Aaron hid it. Okay. What about the rest of Mitzrayim? He didn't hear all of that. Pasuk Yutes, Vayim Asher Moshe Amor El Aaron Kach Matcha, take your staff Unite Yotcha Amayim Mitzrayim. Stretch out your staff. Interesting. And it will turn into blood. So now the question is, why was it that the Nile, and again, the same thing is happening to them, but it's a different act that brings it about, seemingly. The Nile is turned into blood by being hit. Everything else is turned into blood by having Aaron's staff stretched out in its direction. Why not just do that for everything? I believe that the answer to this question can be found in the words of one of the Rishonim, and perhaps we may add one or two comments. One of the great Balei HaTosfos is a Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam. His name was Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. And he has a radical thing to say. But he backs it up, and he'll show it. Says the Bechor Shor, it seems to me that the Makkah of Dam, the water was turned into blood, and it lasted for 7 days. That doesn't mean that the water was blood for 7 days. The plague was for 7 days. What does that mean? What happened to the blood? The water was turned into blood long enough to have the effect that is described in the Pasuk, that it killed the fish, and they rotted, and rendered the water undrinkable. At that point, it turned back into water, but you couldn't drink it. And says the Bechor Shor, that is why the Pasuk says in Yudches, V'hadaga asher bayor tamus uva'ash hayor, the fish will die, which seems to be, an unfortunate collateral side effect. If it's blood, it's one of the many things that are true, if it turns into blood, the fish will die. But it's highlighted here, because that really is the Makkah. The fish will die, uva'ash hayor, the whole thing will become putrid, they won't be able to drink the water of the Nile, says the Bechor Shor. If it's blood, so then how can you even talk about not being able to drink the water? Well, there is no water. It's blood. But no, says the Bechor Shor. It was blood long enough to kill the fish and have that putrefying effect on the water, but then it turned back. There's water there. Water, water everywhere. Not a drop to drink. And with this, says the Bechor Shor, I understand on a simple level what the answer is to a question that has bothered many. Namely, as we know, all the water in Egypt was turned into blood. Okay, then what happened next? Paro's magicians, they also turned water into blood. So it says the Bechor Shor, that what water? In other words, if it's all blood, so then there's not what to turn into water. And there are many answers to this question. Maybe they had to buy the water, which really, if you're looking for the idea of a dafkanik min hatorah minalon, to purchase water in order to then turn it into blood again, means you have a point that you wish to make. Okay. Or any of the other answers that are given. But says the Bechor Shor, as far as I'm concerned, the answer is right in front of us, because it didn't stay blood for that long. It's back in water. There's plenty of water. You can't drink it. So if you can't drink it, you may as well turn it into blood. That's his explanation. Now, adkan the words of the Bechor Shor. Now, it's very clear from his words that he understands that what he is saying is true of Makas Dam, meaning it was blood temporarily and then turned back into water. Those are his words. I would like to suggest, picking up his coattails of the Bechor Shor, that perhaps this is what divided the Makas Dam experience of the Nile as opposed to the other waters in Egypt. If we begin, for example, with his proof in Pasuk Yudches, which we read, Vahadaga asher bayor meisa tamus uva ash hayor. So the fish will die, and the waters will putrefy. Vinilu mitzrayim lishtos maimenet. They won't be able to drink the water, and that's really what he's saying. That means it's not blood. The word yor is mentioned 3 times in that pasuk. One could perhaps take that as saying that this is true of the Nile, and moreover, pasuk kaf aleph, which describes it again, bahadaga asher bayor meisa bayivash hayor. The fish in the Nile died. Once again, a threefold repetition of the word Yor. Especially as it goes on to say, Vayhi hadam b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. They couldn't drink water from the Nile, and there was blood everywhere else. So in terms of the proof of the Bechor Shor, that if you say that you can't drink the water, it means it is water. But that was only ever said with regards to the Nile. Moreover, if the entire effect of the plague is to kill the fish, but that can only work if you have a body of water which has fish. But remember, it's spreading everywhere. It's even going to be in water that's in vessels of wood, vessels of stone. What if there are no fish in those vessels? What if it's just water? You turn it into blood and then turn it back into water, it's just back to the way it was in the first place. And needless to add, of course, the proof of the Bechor Shor is only that there was some water for the Egyptians to turn into blood. And if it's in the Nile, which is where everybody was, that's enough. It doesn't mean that all the other water turned back into water. And in Kainim Hadvarim, if we are correct here, I think this will explain to us why the Torah refers to the Makkah differently between the Nile and the other bodies of water. When it comes to the Nile, the Torah uses the word v'nefchu, which really focuses on the switch. They will turn into blood. When it comes to the other water, it says v'yihiyu dam. What's the difference in connotation between it will turn into blood or it will be blood? The word yihiyu, the Gemara says this on a number of occasions, has a connotation of permanence. V'yihiyu b'hava yoson yihu. That's how it will stay. And therefore, perhaps, the reason why the Torah uses the word v'nefchu when it comes to the Nile is because the focus is on the switch. Not that it will remain that way, but it will turn into blood long enough to do what blood needs to do, and then it will turn back again. V'nefchu, it's a momentary switch, as opposed to the other bodies of water where it just switch into blood. It will stay blood for the duration of the plague. V'yihiyu dam. This will also explain to us why it was a different action that brought about these two after all. It's the same plague, so use the same for both. Except we're dealing with two actions. The first action is a strike. The second action is extending the staff in their direction. I think we can hear a different connotation between a strike, which is a momentary act, like an abrupt contact, as opposed to the extended arm, the Zroa Netuya, which represents an extended time frame. And therefore, because the Nile only momentarily turned into blood, therefore it was brought about by that abrupt action of being struck, as opposed to all the other water, which stayed for a much longer term. So it was that more Zroa Netuya type of extended action that brought about that change. And should we ask, why? What difference does it make? Why should they be different? After all, the Nile's water, this is water. Why should it take the plague, which I think we can see very clearly that it does, but why should it take such a different form between these two? So I think the answer is that the Nile has there's a separate dynamic in terms of what's going on with the Nile than with all the other water. With all the other water, it's tsoros, it's makkos for the Egyptians. Having no water to drink, that's the makkah. With the Nile, it's not just that. The Nile is the deity. Rashi says of the Egyptians, they don't worship water, but they worship the Nile. And therefore, there's a very different interaction between turning the Nile into blood. It's an assault on the deity of the Egyptian. And we have mentioned a number of times that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when it says he hardens Paro's heart, it doesn't mean that he switches Paro's decision-making apparatus off. It means that he plays on Paro's stubbornness. He gives Paro's what you could call loopholes for delusion, whereby if he's only obstinate enough to preserve a certain stance, he will do so. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give him things to latch onto, which no sane person would do. But for Paro, he's already made up his mind, and he'll keep going on this. That's what it means to harden Paro's heart. And every Makkah had one, and this was the one within the Nile. You see, what appears to be happening is that all of Egypt is turned into blood, and then after a few moments, the Nile turns back into water again. Now, what does that mean? This is what allows Paro to believe that the Nile defended itself. All the other proletariat, the bodies of water, so they're, what could they do? They're no match for Moshe. But he turned the Nile into blood, and you see, within a few minutes later, it's back in water again, and that's chizuk for Paro. But what's the moral of the story? The Nile is a match for Moshe. Look at it, if you can bear to look at it. Don't smell it, because you won't be able to bear that. Amongst the stench of rotting fish and putrid water, Paro claims a victory. That's the hardening of Paro's heart. But he's given this idea to latch onto. And that, I believe, is why the Nile is treated differently. This is the heart. Through this, Paro's heart is hardened. I would just like to conclude with one idea, or one PS, which really ties these two things together. And that's why I mentioned them both together. Once we see that the two bodies of water, they're dealt with so differently, the Nile is hit, and all the other bodies of water are an extensive staff. So I'll ask a she'elas tam. Moshe can't hit the Nile because the Nile protected him. But why can't he stretch his staff out on all the other bodies of water? And in fact, it's only there that he says to Aaron to stretch out his staff, but he doesn't have it, presumably, he doesn't have a debt of hakaras hatov to every body of water else in Mitzrayim, only to the Nile. But once you see that they have two destinies, and again, he's only hitting the Nile, the other bodies of water, he's not hitting it, he's just stretching out his staff. So why couldn't they divide the makas dam between them? It's an interesting shaila. He'll be yotzei mitzad hakaras hatov to the Nile, Aaron can hit the Nile, Moshe can do everything else, because he's the default. It's an interesting shaila, and I haven't seen anyone ask this question. But I think the answer is, or at least part of the answer is, I would suggest that once we understand that the Nile turning back into water after just a few moments is part of hardening Paro's heart, and it's laid out there for Paro to latch onto, there could be no difference in terms of who does these two things. Because if it was Aaron for Hakaras HaTov reasons, who hits the Nile, and Moshe does everything else, so then Paro wouldn't go for it. He wouldn't take the bait, pardon the expression. Because he would say, the Nile made a comeback because Moshe, Moshe didn't do that. I mean, maybe that's why. Maybe the difference between them is because that was done through Aaron, who it's known to be on a lesser level of potency than Moshe, and therefore the field was leveled. Aaron does everything, and still the Nile makes the comeback. Paro's heart is hardened. And that's Hakofa Aleph, and the rest of the nine plagues ensue. Mitzvah Hashem, we'll pick up a discussion next week.